This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Speak a little bit about Beyond Claremont and the programs that they do. Again, we're very delighted to have them here with us and for arranging Dr. Brown's visit. Jihad Turk.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Jazakumullah khair. Thanks to Omar and also to Sheikh Nu'man, who I understand is traveling in Pakistan, and then I think we'll be making the Hajj this year, for inviting us and welcoming us to share with you some of our visiting scholars. Bayan Claremont is a new accredited Islamic graduate school at Claremont School of Theology, and we offer degrees in Islamic studies and Islamic leadership. And the way that we offer those degrees is to bring the top scholars in the field from around the country, from institutions like Georgetown, where Dr. Brown is, as well as places like Duke and Stanford and Berkeley and Yale, and have them teach the course that they're the leading expert in. And to do so in a way that's convenient for them, that they don't have to leave their institution for a whole semester, they come for 1 week and they teach intensively 2/3 of the class face-to-face, and then the rest is online spread out over the course of the semester. And we're able to, in this fashion, combine two classes in 1 week and two classes in the next week. So in a two-week period, you get four classes, the face-to-face portion of four classes, and for the student is only committed for a full-time student, 2 weeks a semester, the rest is online. At the end of a two-year period, you'll have an MA in religion, Islamic studies, and leadership, which is a good balance between Islamic studies traditionally, and we're a seminary, so we can we bring Muslim faculty and scholars to teach from an internal perspective, but also an academic perspective, information on traditional Islamic sciences of fiqh and hadith and Quran and Islamic history as well, and tafsir. But also we have classes on leadership, how to counsel the youth, how to give a good khutbah, something that our community is always in need of. Also how to be successful as a community leader. So we have courses, almost like a management course, a nonprofit management course for the Muslim community. So I just wanted to thank Institute of Knowledge, for it is a pillar of learning and education, in Islamic education here in Southern California. And we're looking forward to bringing regularly some of our visiting faculty, maybe a couple times a year. I think Dr. Ovamir Enjum is going to be coming in February, and we're looking to schedule a time for him to visit with you as well at that time. Dr. Jonathan Brown, who is the speaker for this evening, is a professor at Georgetown University, and his specialization is hadith, the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. And he's teaching a class for us on the life, times, and teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He's an author of many books. He's done his doctoral work in the compilation of Sahih Muslim and Sahih al-Bukhari. He's written a book on hadith as well. He's done a very short introduction to the life of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And his most recent book, which we caught Sheikh Farhan Zubairi reading when we entered this evening, it's called Misquoting Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So with no further, I asked Jonathan before coming up, I said, well, anything else I should mention about you? He said, I really like South Asian food. So other than that, with that introduction, please welcome Dr. Jonathan Brown.
Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Innal hamdalillah wa bihi nasta'in. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidil mursalin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Amma ba'd. I won't use this thing because I don't know how to put it on my head, first of all. Second of all, it looks like TED Talks or something like that. So I'll just use this one. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks to the Bayan program for inviting me. And thank you for hosting this event. I was flattered to see one person holding my book. Holding is pretty close to reading. Another person thumbing through, maybe disapprovingly or no, we'll see. So I'm very honored and happy to see that people are interested in it. I'm actually going to talk about something today that I deal with in the book, and so if you want more information on it, you can look in. I think it's the last chapter of the book, and it's actually something that we've, you know, it's you know, life as a Muslim is interesting. Every week, about every week, there's something new in the news. There's a new thing to be, you know, where you know, some Muslims doing this, some Muslims doing that. Somebody says this about Islam, somebody says that about Islam. But this last week, I think there was the NFL that was in the news. The NFL was in the news because of spousal abuse or domestic violence. I don't actually watch any sports, so I have no idea who these people are. But Muslims also know about the issue of domestic abuse, not only because, like every community, it's a reality in our community and a reality that we have to combat. And that it's very much the teachings of our Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, and the teachings of our God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the tradition of our scholars that we should prevent, by all means possible, members of families from physically harming each other, because this is not the tradition of our Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam. So I wanted to talk actually today about this verse of the Quran, verse 434, that probably everybody knows about because, and I say this, you know, not from a perspective of criticizing the Quran, obviously, but I think that in a lot of ways this verse is the most problematic verse for Muslims in the modern world. Why? Well, it's not a hadith. You know, hadiths are really, even if you have very, very sound hadith, it's almost always subject is, there's a possibility there's a mistake. It's a possibility that the wording is wrong or that there's been a mistake. It's not as epistemologically certain as the words of the Quran. The Quran you cannot avoid. You can't get around it. You can't say it's not authentic. In addition, this verse of the Quran, which I'm sure you know, وَاللَّاتِ تَخَافُونَ نَشُوزَهُنَّ فَعِذُهُنَّ وَحَجَرَهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ وَضْرِبُهُنَّ وَإِنْ أَطَعْنَكُمْ فَلَا تَبْغُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ سَبِيلًا إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ عَلِيًّا كَبِيرًا. This verse says, first it talks about, you know, men are the responsible for caretakers of women because of how God has favored some over others and by what we assume men spend out of their money on women, and then that righteous women are goodly and pious and chaste, and then it talks about women who do not manifest those characteristics, and it says that those women of whose nushuz, the Arabic word, of whose nushuz you are certain, and nushuz is a difficult word to define, but I think usually it's maybe egregious disrespect or egregiously inappropriate behavior might be a good translation. Those women of whose nushuz you are certain, first admonish them, then abandon them in their beds. And, you know, there's some little kids in the audience, but the general, you know, you would not do jima'ah, you would not do nikah with your wife. And then finally, strike them. And if the woman at any point desists from her behavior, seek no other path against her. Indeed, God is high and mighty. So this is the verse of the Quran, at least in my kind of a little bit expanded translation. And there, you may come across some people who try and argue that the word daraba here in this verse doesn't mean to strike or to hit. I think I wish that were true, because then we're going to have this discussion about the verse, and we could all go home and eat, you know, nahara you eat in the day. Eat kheer. How about that? That's tasty. We eat that at night. We could all go home and eat that. We wouldn't have to worry about it. The fact of the matter is that I think that in one sense, the sunnah of the Prophet actually makes it clear that this verse is talking about striking. And so we have to, Muslims have to deal with this. And I think one of the questions that comes into Muslims' mind in the U.S. is, or in the West, is, you know, how could God say this? How is it that, how could God say this? How could God instruct men to strike their wives? And a kind of subset of that, or sub-objection to this is, you know, my teachers, they tell me that this doesn't really mean that men should strike their wives. This means that, you know, you can only hit your wife with a you know, rolled up handkerchief or something like that. And, but that, why doesn't the Quran say that? Why does the Quran say strike them? Why doesn't it say strike them really lightly or strike them but only with a rolled up handkerchief, you know? Finally, why, let's say that sometimes it is okay for a husband to strike his wife. Why would God allow this, give men this excuse, if he knows men are going to abuse this excuse? If he knows men are going to abuse this excuse, why would God create that, open the door even just a little bit for this? So these are, inshallah, I'm going to try and discuss these topics this evening, bidnillah. Now, to begin this discussion, it's very important that we address something basic that I think we all often take for granted in the English language, which is, what does it mean when a book or a speaker says something literally, right? So if you were to say to someone comes up to you and says, hey, what's up with the Quran? How come the Quran says husbands should strike their wives? You say, oh, no, it doesn't really say that. It says, you know, you have to understand it in the context. And he says, no, but it says, adribuhunna, it says strike them. It literally says that. You'll probably hear someone, they say, it literally says that. Be very, very, very wary of this word literally. Anytime somebody says literally, your brain, you know, red light should start going off in your brain. Like lawyers say, you know, whenever somebody says clearly, it's not clear what they're actually talking about. No one. There is actually no such thing as literal meaning. There is no such thing as literal meaning. Why is that? You could say, oh, wait, look, let's take a sentence. Then strike them. We can look up the words them, then. We can look up the words strike. We can look up the word them in the dictionary. And that's the literal meaning. Except, as anyone who's ever tried to read Shakespeare knows, the meaning of words changes over time. So when Sherlock, we read Sherlock Holmes mysteries, if anyone ever reads Sherlock Holmes, he always says, Watson, I'm going to do my toilet now. You're like, ooh, why are you talking about this? You know, just excuse yourself. Because back then, toilet meant you're going to go and shave and brush your hair. It doesn't, and then it's like, you know, people are always looking for cleaner, more polite ways to talk about what they're really doing. So eventually toilet came to mean what we understand it. And now we say, I'm going to the bathroom. And probably 50, 60 years from now, going to the bathroom will be really gross. So we'll say something like, I'm going to go to some room. I don't know. Who knows what we'll say. The point is, the meaning of words changes over time. Second of all, context is always part of how we understand something we read or say or hear said. And when we talk about literal meaning, what we're really talking about is something else. It's called, scholars of language and communication call it evident meaning. Evident meaning. And by the way, here Muslim scholars were about, you know, 1,200 years ahead, and they said there's, it's called zahir, zahir an-nas, the evident meaning of the text, the meaning that comes to you quickest, most immediately, the meaning that you arrive at with the least number of steps in your mind. That's the evident meaning. Now, the evident meaning is oftentimes very different from the dictionary meaning, you know, where you go and look up words. For example, if somebody says, you know, I'm sorry to use this example a lot, but it's a good one. If you're walking in a dark alley at night and someone comes out with a gun and says, give me your money, give me all your money. You know, literally, oh, dictionary-wise, all my money would be all my liquid assets, and I'd have to go to the ATM machine, get my money in the bank account. I have to go and liquidate my 401k or whatever like that. That's not what the person means. They mean, give me what's in your wallet, and they mean probably give me your watch and stuff like that as well. You don't sit there and go through a calculation in your mind. You know immediately what they mean. That's the evident meaning. It's actually very different from the dictionary meaning. The evident meaning is determined by your culture, by context, by tone. And I love, you know, I love movies like the Naked, anyone see the Naked Gun movies or, you know, Airplane? These movies are so funny because they're oftentimes the jokes are about people who don't understand, who are outside, who are making fun of the, they're outside the culture that understands evident meaning. So when somebody says, you know, there's news from the hospital. Person says, hospital, what's that? The other person says, oh, it's a building and has patients in it and there's doctors and nurses. You know, he means like, what's the news from the hospital? But the joke is, so the person is literally saying, what's the hospital? So it's this idea of the, one of the people is kind of clueless about the evident meaning. This gives endless possibility for jokes. Why am I getting into all this? Because when somebody comes up to you and says, the Quran literally says something, you immediately have to ask yourself, how is it that we should understand the Quran? How is the Quran understood? Is the Quran understood based on evident meaning? Or is the Quran always engaged at deeper levels, at more profound levels, at more derivative levels? And that's the case. The Quran is always engaged at a deeper level. And this is a function of the very nature of the Quran as a text. The Quran is a text that is revealed in time. It's revealed in, it's totally wrapped up in the events of the Prophet's life, alayhi salam. It's completely wrapped up in the questions that are posed to him, in the challenges that the Muslim community faces, in their defeats, their victories, their fears, their hopes. Some verses of the Quran are universal. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. The believers are felicitous. Those verses, they soar above time. They soar above circumstance. But there's other verses that are wrapped up in the life of the Prophet. You know, when the تَبَّتْ يَدَى أَبِي لَهَبٍ وَتَبْ. Who's Abu Lahab? Who's Abu Lahab? What is it talking? Why are his hands perished? What is this talking about? This, you have to know the context. When people in the West think of Scripture, they think of the Bible, and the Bible is a text that is it's a cornerstone of the Western literary canon. It is one of the two or three big cornerstones. It defines the way we think in the United States, in the West, the way we think about what a text, what a book should be. It has a beginning, it has an end. Each book is chronological. You can follow it. There's a plot. There's not parts that are mixed up in time. There's not parts that aren't set very clearly against their background in the life of, you know, Moses or Joshua or Jesus. That's not the nature of the Quranic text. The Quranic text is this segment of divine consciousness. It's like a stream of consciousness that is caught up in the temporal world, caught up in the world of man. And that's always how Muslims understood it. There is no Muslim sect, no Muslim school of thought, not Sunni, not Shia, not even Ismaili, that reads the Quran alone. All Muslim sects, no matter how far out you go on the spectrum, they always read the Quran through, does anybody know what they read it through? They read it through a lens. Does anyone know what that lens is? The Sunnah of the Prophet. They read it through the Sunnah of the Prophet. And now, sometimes you'll hear about, you know, Quran-only movements or Quran-only groups. My biggest objection to Quran-only groups is that you cannot read the Quran alone. It's impossible. There are words in the Quran, phrases in the Quran that don't exist anywhere else. They don't. They only appear once in the Quran, like the discussion of dhihar, those alladhina yudahiruna azwajuhum. There's no other way to understand what this means, except from the traditions of the Prophet ﷺ and his companions that explain this is a man who says to his wife, "You're like the back of my mother to me." There's no other way to understand this. You have to rely on the Sunnah of the Prophet. And it is the Sunnah of the Prophet and the way of the early Muslim community and the tradition of the scholars who built on their understanding of the Quran. It is that lens through which we read the Quran, and it is that lens that takes us away from the evident meaning to the intended meaning of the text. This is very important. When the Quran says, إِنَّمَا الْمُشْرِكُونَ نَجَسٌ, the Quran says, indeed, polytheists are najas. We all know what najas means, right? You're probably all Hanafis, I'm guessing. So you have a good understanding of what najas means. If you go and you shake hands with Mr. Najas, and Mr. Najas has just come in from his jog, and he's nice and sweaty, and he's, nice to meet you. And you shake, what are you going to have to do now? You have to go wash your hands. You can't pray. Okay. If you sit there and Mr. Najas is eating food with you, you know, putting finger in his mouth and he's taking more food and he reaches over to your food, things like that. Now what do you do? Can you marry Mrs. Najas? No. Does anyone remember from the life of the Prophet, does anyone remember instances where he shakes, you know, Abu Talib's hand? He's like, gotta go wash. I've just made my shirt najasa. I have to go. Can't touch anything. I have to go wash my hands. Does anyone remember instance in the life of the Prophet where that happens? Does anyone know instance where he doesn't want to eat food with mushrikun or doesn't want to let them into his mosque to talk to him? So how do we know that this verse cannot be literal? It cannot be the evident meaning. We know it because the Sunnah of the Prophet shows us it has to be another meaning. And this is what Muslim scholars, with the exception of a very few in the early period, this is what they all understood this verse as meaning. It's not the bodies of the mushrikeen that are najas. It's their beliefs. Their beliefs are filthy, not their bodies. We know this because the Prophet never acted in a way that their bodies were filthy. And that's the principle that Muslim scholars came up with. It's called at-tahara al-adamiyya, that all the human body, us in its default state, is pure. It's important to remember this. It is very important to remember this when you think about the Quran and when people ask you about the Quran. Because if you're a regular, let's say, English speaker, American person, for you, a far-fetched meaning, a meaning that's really pushing it, an explanation that's really pushing it, is one that is distant from the evident meaning of a statement or a piece of writing. So if you say to somebody, there's actually an interesting case in a legal case where police officer interrupts a robbery, and one of the guys, robbers, has a gun, and the police officer says, "Give me the gun." And one of the robbers says to the other one, "Let him have it." So what does he mean? Does he mean let him have the gun, or does he mean let him have it, right? Shoot him. This is a good example. This is not pushing it. If the robber says, no, I meant let him have the gun. But if I meant, you know, if the robber said, let me try and think of something, you know, give it to him good. If the robber said, give it to him, buddy. And then he went in court and he said, no, I didn't mean shoot him five times. I meant, you know, give it to him good. You know, give it to him. Yes, good. Give him the gun. Then everyone in the jury is going to say, oh, yeah, right. No. That's pushing it. That's too far. That's how we interact with each other in language. But when you have a text like the Quran that is always read through the Sunnah of the Prophet, you have to look at what the Sunnah of the Prophet is telling you to understand the intended meaning of the text. And in that case, The intended meaning of God's words is not necessarily the one that's closest to the evident meaning. It is the one that is best supported by the evidence of the other verses of the Quran, of the Sunnah of the Prophet, of our understanding of the overall teachings of Islam. This is what tells us the intended meaning of the Quran. And so when we read that verse that I mentioned, the verse 434, the quote-unquote wife-beating verse, when you read that, you don't read it through what comes to your mind first. You read it what comes to your mind after you understand the Sunnah of the Prophet. And the Sunnah of the Prophet on this issue is very clear. What does Aisha say in Sahih Hadith? She says, the Prophet, ما ضرب أحدا قط. The Prophet never struck anybody بيدهي. Never struck anybody with his hand, except not a man, not a woman, not a servant, except in the path of jihad. Never struck anybody. And when this verse is revealed that I read to you about Adribu Hunna, the context in which it's revealed, according to Hadith and Sunan Tirmidhi and other books, is that a woman comes to the Prophet and complains about her husband striking her. And the Prophet says, لا تدربوا إماء الله. Do not strike the female servants of God. And then Omar comes to the Prophet, depending on the version of the Hadith, comes to the Prophet and says, you know, the women in Medina are not, they're very, they're kind of overcoming their husbands. You know, they're very like forceful in their personalities. They're not like the women in Mecca. And so then then this verse is revealed and talks about how that, you know, if your wife is having nushuz, first you admonish her, she does not desist, then you see sleeping with her, she still continues, then the verse says you strike her. But what does the Prophet say about that? He said, أُولَٰئِكَ لَيْسَ أُولَٰئِكَ خِيَارَكُمْ. Those people who strike their wives are not the best of you. In another version of the Hadith in the Mustadrak of Al-Hakam and Naysaburi, he says, خِيَارَكُمْ لَنْ تَدْرِبُوا. The best of you will not strike your wives. And in Sahih Bukhari, the Prophet says, alayhi salatu wasalam, لَا يَجْلِدُ أَحَدُكُمْ إِمْرَأَتُهُ جَلْدَ الْعَبْدِ ثُمَّ يُجَامِعُهُ آخَرَ النَّهَارِ أو آخَرَ الْيَوْمِ. Let one of you, let none of you strike his wife like he'd strike a slave and then go and sleep with her at the end of the day. And in his final sermon, his final khutbah at Hajj, what is one of the things the Prophet says? He says, Al-taqullah fi nisa'ikum. Fear God as concerns your wives, because you have taken them as a trust from God. They're in your trust. And he says, only if they do commit what's called, what he says is a fahisha mubayyina, an egregious, you know, inappropriate behavior, egregious fahisha, then strike them, but what? Only strike them darbat ghayr mubarrih, in a way that leaves no mark, that causes no harm. So that's the sunnah of the Prophet that we have to, that through which we read this verse, and through which every Islamic school of thought would read this verse. Which is why in the various schools of law, and you now, a lot of you are students here, you know how complicated fiqh is. You know how many different opinions, like for example in the Hanafi madhab, you can have, you know, Zahir Riwaya, and you have the opinion of Imam Abi Hanifa, you have the opinion of Abu Yusuf, you have the opinion of Muhammad bin Hassan Shibani, you have the opinion of Zufar bin Hudayl, of all these opinions. So fiqh is very complicated. But across the different madhabs, there's the same theme over and over again. You can only strike your wife lightly, in a way that causes no harm. If you cause her harm, you're liable for the dia. You're liable for compensating her for injuries. And according to every school except the Hanafi school, a judge, if a wife goes to a judge and says, my husband's beating me, and there's witnesses or evidence that the husband's beating her, or the husband confesses, the judge can do what's called tafriq. He can end the marriage legally. And the wife will get to keep her mahr, and the husband has to pay her nafaqah until her iddah ends, and the marriage is over. And this is what I found very interesting in my research, that if you look at Sharia court, information about Sharia courts, whether it's in, you know, Iran in the 900s, or Andalusia in the 900s, or Syria in the 1300s, or, you know, Jenay and Mali in the 1900s, or Zanzibar in the 1900s, or Yemen in the mid-20th century, or Egypt in the 1920s, you always see the same thing. Husband or wife goes to the court, says, my husband's beating me. If there's evidence that he's beating her, like physically, if there's witnesses, if the husband confesses, judge would end the marriage. If the woman wants, he'll end the marriage. She keeps her dowry. She gets maintenance. And the husband, if there's injury, has to pay to compensate the injury. And this is, for example, in the Hanafi realm of Palestine in the 17th century, there's one case where a woman has some of her teeth knocked out by her husband, and the judge says, you have to pay, husband, you have to pay your wife 3 gold coins because this is the dia for teeth. And so it's very interesting because in the tradition of American law and British law, it's only in the very late 19th century or in the 20th century that a husband can ever have to pay any money to his wife. Before then, married women aren't allowed to own property. And there's something called in law tort immunity, where the husband's actually immune from any case that his wife brings against him that he harmed her. It's impossible for him to be liable financially to her. But in the Islamic tradition, since the very beginning, since the life of the Prophet, part of the Sharia was that just because you're married to somebody doesn't mean that if you injure them, you don't have to pay for it. You can't be held accountable before the law. You're always held accountable. In the Sharia, if you harm anybody, you're held accountable. Doesn't matter if they're your wife or your husband. The last point I want to talk about is the last one I mentioned in my introduction. Why would God even create the possibility of misunderstanding? Why would God open the door to domestic violence at all by having this verse? There's two important things I'd like you to keep in mind. One is that violence is part of human language. There's a principle in, you know, study of language and communications, you know, that arguments is war. Argument is war. So when human beings talk about disagreement and arguments, we use it the language of war. You know, I have a good defense against that point. Or why are you attacking my what I was thinking? Or so-and-so is launching a campaign against this idea. These are all the language of warfare. When I was listening on the radio yesterday about the Ebola outbreak, people say America is sending forces to defeat Ebola or combat Ebola. I mean, I was thinking about how do you combat a disease? How do you fight a disease? You know, I'm sure there's doctors in the room, given the audience. But I mean, it's you don't fight, you don't sit there and, you know, punch the disease, you don't elbow the disease, right? You investigate, you wipe things and you inject things and you do all sorts of. It's really weird to, in a way, to think about this as fighting, but that's the way we can't help but talk about our arguments and our conflicts in the language of war. If you think about, it's almost impossible to imagine writing a message or writing a book or writing a text of any kind or giving a speech where you never, ever fall into the idiom of warfare, the idiom of violence. It's certainly, I think, impossible if you are writing a text that is addressing a community that has that is at war, like the Muslims were, or that it that is a text designed to guide mankind for all time and for all places, when mankind is always disagreeing with each other, always fighting, either with words or with sticks or swords, how do you talk to people like who live in that world without ever using the idiom of violence? And when you use the idiom of violence, that idiom can be misunderstood. And even the New Testament, even the words of Jesus in the New Testament, which is one of the most pacifist books you can read, even the idiom of even the New Testament was understood by Christians in violent ways. So a very famous early Christian scholar named Origen, he died around 235 of the Common Era. He's from the city of Alexandria. Origen, he read a verse of the Gospel of Matthew that says, talks about those who make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven. It's obviously talking about people who, you know, يُحَافِذُونَ عَلَى فُرُوجِهِمْ الْحَافِذُونَ عَلَى فُرُوجِهِمْ. That's not how Origen understood it. He actually castrated himself. His student writing about this calls it, you know, Origen's headstrong act. He was like, you know, got a little carried away. So he actually understood this verse as he should castrate himself. In another verse in the New Testament, Jesus talks about, he gives the parable, the methel, of a dinner party that a master is giving, and he wants to bring everybody in the neighborhood to the dinner party. This is a parable of God inviting people to the kingdom of heaven. And the master says to his servants, go into the street, and if people don't want to come to my dinner, compel them to come to my dinner. Compel them to come. Some points in Christian history, they use this as justification for forced conversion, for forcing people to convert to Christianity, like in the Spanish Inquisition. So they take the language of Jesus, the language of peace and love, and it gets turned into the excuse for violence, the excuse for compulsion, force. So there's never a text that is immune to being understood in a violent way. And my last point, and this is a very important point, people in the West love to talk about the problem of Islam, the problem of Muslims. They say Muslims treat women badly. Muslims are violent towards women. And you know why? Look at their Quran. Their Quran is the reason. Is that Isha time? Okay. Does anybody know a reason why this is not true? Because other people also treat women badly. Violence against women is a human problem. Do you know which country in the world rates the worst in terms of violence against women in the whole world? Not India, not Saudi Arabia. El Salvador. El Salvador. Do you know how many Muslims there are in El Salvador? Not very many. Okay. Latin America, actually, according to the 2012 UN report, is the worst region in terms of violence against women. And this goes to show how, I think, misleading public discussion in America is, and the West is, because I didn't even know about dowry killings until, like, 2012. I didn't even know they existed. Like, maybe some of you are from India. You know what dowry killings are. Dowry killings is when a husband or a husband's family kills the new wife, or sometimes a wife that's been the wife for a while of the husband or of the son, because she's, you know, her family didn't give enough presents, or because she's not been good enough wife. According to the 2012 UN report, in 2009 there were some 5,600 dowry killings in India that year. That there's sometimes, you know, one killing a day in Delhi alone. And sometimes these women are burned alive. And then the family says it was a kitchen accident. And the police don't investigate it. This is a huge problem. No one in America even knows about this. Because what are people in America always talking about? Honor killings. Muslims are the ones who are killed. There's more Dowry, usually, if, you know, according to the statistics we have for certain years, there are more killings in India amongst Hindus than of all the honor killings in the Muslim world. But no one even knows about that. Because when you get to blame Muslims and talk about how Muslims are the problem, who gets off the hook? Everybody else. Who gets off the hook? We in America get off the hook. We don't talk about violence against women in our own societies. And I was just, when I was in the UK last weekend, or maybe 2 weeks ago, I can't remember when it was, there was I was on the tube, the underground train, and the guy next to me is reading this big full-page headline. It says, Muslim convert beheads granny in garden. I was like, oh, wow. It turns out it wasn't a Muslim. Someone, some crazy person beheaded this lady. And then there was a few days later a very interesting newspaper article by a woman in a newspaper called The Spectator. She says, in my neighborhood in the last year, three women have been beheaded. Nobody talked about it. Nobody cared. Because this is important when it's terrorism, when it's Muslims being violent. Then people pay attention. But when it's our own society, no one cares. Terrorism is important, but violence against women is the daily hum, is the background hum of our daily lives. This is what she said. This is a very important statement. People don't think about that. And when Muslims, when we allow ourselves to simply be the, when we allow ourselves to be the center of conversation, we say, oh, you know, please, you know, let me defend Islam against your accusations that Islam is bad against, is, you know, attacks women, or Islam is misogynist, Islam is unfair to women. You know, Muslims have problems of violence against women in their communities. Muslims have problems of mistreatment of women in the United States, in every country. And those problems need to be addressed by the Muslim community. We need to address those issues. But it can't be an excuse that other people in our country don't also address the issues that they have. No, we can't be the scapegoat by which other people are allowed to avoid self-criticism. I'm happy to maybe answer questions, or if you have any comments, for the next few minutes until the Isha prayer starts, inshallah. Yes.
You know, description and justification of this verse, etc. But I suppose there is another way entirely to deal with this, which is to say that perhaps this verse has been completely mistranslated by most translators of the Holy Quran into the English language. In particular, there is one translation by Bakhtiar, who uses the phrase "strike out a new path" as opposed to "strike" for the word "daraba," and that translation of the Quran, I realize, has, you know, there's people who question how good a translation that is, but to me, what's important about it, and I'm no scholar, but it has been signed off on by Al Azhar, right? Which is, you know, they have given her a fatwa or whatever, and it's included in the copy of the Quran, and, you know, you can see that it's right there. So my layperson way of thinking about this issue is that if it's good enough for Al-Azhar, right, in all of their historical greatness, to sign off on this particular translation or this particular interpretation, then why is it not good enough for a layperson like me? And her translation completely eliminates the possibility of any domestic violence.
Maybe I can use, no, this is not, okay, I'll just do this. I know the Leila Bakhtiar translation. I think the problem is, well, first of all, I have a lot of affection for Al-Azhar as an institution and for many of its scholars. but I'm not entirely confident in their review process. Now, they may well have, you know, very qualified scholars may well have looked at this book and approved of it. The Azhar scholars, the senior Azhar scholars that I know and have asked about this don't agree with that interpretation, the Bakhtiar interpretation, which has been advanced by others like Abdul Hamid, Abu Sulaiman, and Amin al-Wadud, amongst others. So my main problem with it is that, you know, in the Islamic tradition of interpretation, there's something called qanun al-ta'wil, the rule of interpretation. And what that means is you can't al-haqiqa la tutraku illa in ta'adharat. The evident meaning is not abandoned until it proves impossible. Or you cannot do ta'wil, which is ikhraj an-nas an al-ma'na dhahir ila ma'na ghayra dhahir li sababin awjaba dhalik. That means you cannot abandon the evident meaning of a text for a non-evident meaning of the text unless there is some reason that requires that or justifies that. Okay? So if the Quran said innama al-mushrikuna najas, mushriks are polytheists, are literally filthy, and we knew from the Sunnah of the Prophet that every time he met a pagan, he went and washed his hands and he wouldn't eat with them, etc., etc., the evident meaning would be also the intended meaning, because we have evidence. We have no. If I were to go and say, no, it doesn't mean literally najas, it means there's ideas, I'd say, what justification do you have for abandoning the evident meaning for this other meaning? The only justification is your own desire. So in the Sunnah of the Prophet, we have hadiths in Sahih Muslim and Tirmidhi and Abu Dawud that talk about the Prophet acknowledging that some level of striking a wife is acceptable. In addition, all the Muslim legal scholars who came after the first generations of Muslims believe that they didn't say this verse meant, you know, strike out a new path for them, or other possible meanings. So there's no there's nothing that to justify our choice of a non-evident meaning. There's nothing to justify, and when in that case, the only thing we're using is our own, what the Quran would call ahwa, our own desire, our own whims, our own fancies. And they may be valuable fancies. I mean, they'd be just fancies. You know, I don't think it's right for a husband to strike his wife and hurt her. Right? And I don't want my God and my holy book to say that to me. That's a very, I mean, I don't impugn the integrity and the intention behind that desire. But the Quran is not interpreted according to our desires. The Quran is interpreted according to the Sunnah of the Prophet and the tradition of his teachings, alayhi salatu salam. And the traditions of his teachings are that the best of you will not strike. They are that you cannot harm your wife in any way. They are that, according to, for example, the Shafi'i school, that striking your wife is makruh tahriman. You know, it's a dislike to the point of almost being haram. But you know, as one of my teachers in Azhar, Sheikh Ali Jum'ah, who's recently been, come under some, I think, justified criticism for his political opinions. We won't get into that, but his explanation was, the Quran is a book that is revealed for all people, all times, every community, and he says that there are some places in the world where, women won't. Really won't listen to their husbands unless their husband smacks them. That seems very strange to me and foreign to me and repulsive to me. But then again, so does marrying a 12-year-old. And there's lots of, for most of human history, including in my own ancestors, direct ancestors that I know about, no one had any problem with a 50-year-old guy marrying a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old. And to me now, that seems like a
I mean, it makes me violently ill. But the world doesn't run by my reactions. It doesn't run by our culture. It runs, it's a big place, a diverse place. And the Quran is a text for all that world. So, you know, I asked Sheikh Ali when we were talking about this, I said, well, what do you, you know, don't you think this verse is going to allow, gives a blank check to husbands as to harm their wives? And he says, well, this is the job of ulama. This is the job of Muslim scholars. They have to go out and teach people. They can't strike your wife. You can't hurt your wife. You know, if you strike her, you know, you have to do it in a way that doesn't hurt her. And if you hurt her, she has every right to drag you in front of court, and you're going to have to pay for her injuries, and the judge can well give her a divorce, and you can lose all the dowry. You know, you promised her $50,000 mu'akhar mahar. You're going to have to drop $50,000 mu'akhar mahar. You're going to pay for a nafaqah. So watch it. And one scholar, Muhammad Tahir ibn Ashur, a famous Tunisian scholar, died in 1973. He's a fascinating scholar because he's a traditional scholar. He lived so long, he like lived into the modern world. He was a Sharia court judge in Tunisia. He says his understanding of the verse, because the verse that comes after it, after 434, is the verse really that Muslim scholars paid attention to, which says, "In khifta shaqaqa baynahuma, fa'ab'atha hakaman min ahlihi wa hakaman min ahliha." If you fear, it's not talking about the husband now, it's talking to the society. If you, the court, fear that they're going to split apart, send an arbitrator from her family, an arbitrator from his family, and if they want us to reconcile, God will make that possible. So this was actually the way that Muslim scholars as judges understood their role, that they were supposed to try and reconcile the couple. And so Ibn Ashur says that it's only the court that has the right to discipline the husband, to discipline the wife or husband physically. He says in our society today, husbands will take advantage of this verse, 434, they'll abuse it, they'll hurt their wives. So we need to actually tell husbands it's illegal for them to strike their wives. Only the Muslim judge, a qadi, and the court, they can punish a wife for her nushuz, not the husband.
I can just use this to talk.
Assalamu alaikum. I have two questions. One, in your opinion, what is the best English translation of the Quran? And in the same vein, what is your opinion about the translation by Muhammad Asad? The second part is a question is that there is, I'm sure you know, in the Quran, the expression "uqaru mutashabihat," meaning, of course, you know, that there are some verses in the Quran that are clear in their meaning, and the others are not clear, and the meaning of these verses only Allah knows. And so then how do we get to know what are really the meaning of أُخَرُ مُتَشَابِهَاتِ then?
It's very hard to know what the best translation of the Quran is. I think the Muhammad Asad one is very good. It has excellent footnotes. He has a very clear modernist meaning. You know, he doesn't like angels. He doesn't like miracles. But he has so many good footnotes, and he's a great scholar. So I like the Muhammad Asad translation, but I think that, you know, you always... I think people should always look at more than one translation when they read Quranic verses, because it's impossible to translate, especially a document as rich and as like elliptical as the Quran sometimes. You can't read it without a lot of your own mind coloring your understanding, and that's what happens with translators. I like the Abdul Halim translation, the Asad translation. I like the... Arbery translation. I think these are good to use in combination with each other. The question of أُخْرَى المُتَشَابِهَات versus the آيَاتٌ مُحْكَمَاتٌ.
I think there's lots of verses in the Quran, especially that speak about the nature of God, that speak about the afterlife, speak about the beginning of time, maybe the more delicate areas of human ethics that are ambiguous, that we can't understand in a definitive way. The 434 verse, however, it's clearly a verse that is legal in its implication. I mean, it's a prescription for how to deal with a real life situation. So I don't think that it can fall under the category of mutashabihat, in my opinion. Is this a question?
It is, but I wanted to offer the opportunity for any of the sisters that had any question to ask one as well. So are there any questions from the sisters? I'm going to come back to you.
Yeah, isn't this kind of an important topic? Just saying, I don't know. My students never ask questions, so I'm used to it.
We're going to come back to you, so think about it. But I do have one question from a sister. So it's about homosexuality. Unrelated, but...
That's not a delicate topic at all. This is a very important issue, I think. What is the Islamic perspective on, or how do you discuss the Islamic perspective on homosexuality? I think, you know, the Islamic, by the way, this is going to get a little explicit, which I don't care about, and Muslim scholars love sexually explicit stuff. Audiences sometimes don't like it, but you know what? I don't care. You're going to have to deal with it. If you want to get mad at me afterwards, go ahead. So, the Islamic perspective on homosexuality, I think, is a very good perspective. Okay, in the Islamic tradition, your desires are not a legal issue; they're not a Sharia issue. Okay, I can desire that watch; I really desire it, but I can't take it. Okay, I can desire to commit zina with so many people, and virtually every teenage guy desires that. I don't know about teenage girls. I've never been a girl, but I can tell you teenage guys desire a lot of things that they can't do. They can't do those things. Muslim scholars, when they talked about attraction of men to men or women to women, they didn't talk about that as unnatural attraction because they saw that, especially with like a young boy, that if a man is attracted to a young boy, they're confused because they see female beauty in the boy, and they desire the boy, right? So they didn't say that's unnatural. It actually was natural to be attracted to the female beauty. It's just the person was kind of confused, and sometimes they talked about medical conditions that could cause this. So there wasn't this in the especially the modern Western tradition. There's this notion of the unnaturalness of homosexuality. The word homosexual is actually coined in the mid 1800s, I think, by a Hungarian or Austrian psychologist who's diagnosing this psychological ill. It's something that's a disease you have in your brain. Something's wrong with you. That's not the way the Islamic tradition looked at it. The Islamic tradition looked at this as kind of a confused but natural desire. But you can't act on it. You can't act on it. The Islamic tradition also, it's a very specific act that is wrong. That when you talk about liwat, or the act of the people of Lot, of Lut, is, according to fiqh, idkhal al-dhakar fi dubur, dhakar kana aw mu'annath. Okay. I mean, they asked the question. It's not my fault. Okay, it's very explicit. That's the wrong thing. What you feel in your heart, what you desire, is not wrong. I mean, it can't be wrong. It's not a crime because you're not doing anything. And in the Islamic tradition, as Imam Shafi'i said, or it's often attributed to the Prophet, but it's really just a jurist statement, Muslim scholars. أُمِرْنَا أَن نَحْكُمْ بِالظَّاهِرِ وَاللَّهُ يَتَوَلَّى السَّرَائِرِ. We've been commanded to rule by what people act, how they act outwardly. God knows what's in their hearts. God knows what's in their hearts. So this is the Islamic perspective of homosexuality. What you're born with, what you desire, this is not anybody's business. It's, you know, you have these desires, as I have desires. But if you engage in this specific act, liwat, this is a serious sin. Like the other hudud punishments, however, the policy of Muslim scholars as judges and of Muslim courts has always been, you know, you let the person off as much as you can with any ambiguities you can find. And in the case of homosexuality or the liwat, it was really like kind of don't ask, don't tell. As long as you're not going out publicly and doing something like zina, you know, people, as long as you don't go out publicly and do something, it's really almost impossible for a Muslim court to bring you in and punish you for something. This is your problem, this is a sin you commit. The Sharia has made clear the seriousness of this sin, but it's also made clear that it's the duty of Muslim scholars as judges, as the Prophet said, to udru al-hudud bishubahat. Ward off the hudud as much as you can by any ambiguity you can find. Let the person go if you can find a way out. It is better for the judge to err in mercy than to err in severity. So that's the Islamic perspective on homosexuality, as far as I understand it, uniformly.
Any questions from the sisters? All right, I'm going to come back to you again. Yes, brother.
Jazakallah khair for the talk so far. So the question I had was one, Jazakallah khair for kind of reminding us of the kind of linguistic context that we have to interpret the actual diction of the Quran and also the interpretive context of the Sunnah. The question I had, and you touched on it briefly, but I just wanted to maybe be a little more explicit about, if you've addressed it, it might not be the trajectory of your work, but specifically the cultural context. And that, say, at the time of the Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you know, the culture in which he was speaking to, the kind of prescription laid on in the Quran might have been more a refraining prescription than necessarily a prescriptive one to strike, because it lays out a number of steps that you have to do first before you even approach or even think about striking. And so that might, you know, kind of be more in line for us to see as with his general character of gentleness than we interpret it today. And the flip side of the cultural context, I think, and perhaps you deal with this in your book, is our own context in the modern day of where this even becomes a question. I guess we could say, clearly in our society now, it's a question because how could you allow for a violent act in a domestic situation? But clearly it happens, and it happens very frequently, if not exceedingly frequently. So what is it that brings the question about if it's, changing definitions of marital relations, social relations, views of the public and what's allowed there and the private and what's allowed there and kind of the encroachment of the two? It seems like, at a certain point the question became relevant in a different way than simply, this is morally wrong. So I don't know if that's clear, but...
So it's interesting that the very nature of your question, I think, it's clearly applies to this situation. When it is controversial or extremely when there's a lot of tension around an issue, it doesn't mean that it's decided. It means that it's really contested. Okay? So just one of my friends is a professor. He's teaching right now in Alabama. He asked his students about this incident of the guy, the NFL player, who was beating his kid with a switch. And the professor asked his students, a big class, said, how many of you have ever been beaten with a switch? and basically all of them said you had. And they were white, black students, everything. And he said, well, you know, this NFL player, he's leaving welts on the child. And they said, yeah, that's what happens when you beat somebody with it, when you get hit by a switch. So it's clear that in the United States, there's actually a big debate, the big division about how whether it's appropriate to strike your children, to spank your children. And if you're in like an urban context, and if you're in an urban American context, in a liberal context, in a university, if you go and say you want to spank your children, everybody thinks you're like a psychopath. Okay? There's other parts of the country, huge parts of the country, where that's totally normal. That's a very contested issue. A very contested issue. So you're right to point out that a lot of this tension isn't about the Quran. It's about our own unease with how do we understand the relationship between gender, between the gender. I mean, and you can see this very clearly in the way that law in America develops. The fact that it's only in the last several decades that you even have a courts caring about husbands beating their wives. Until the early 20th century or someplace the late 19th century, I mean, if somebody said, you know, someone's beating their wife, a court would never care. And then there's been so much change, even since the 1960s, in how courts deal with this. At first, the approach was that police were just supposed to break up the fight if they get a 911 call, try and get the couple to cool down, and then go, you know, leave. Then in the 80s, it became this movement of, you know, mandatory arrest, that if you get a 911 call, the police officer has to arrest the aggressive party or the primary aggressor. The problem was then you'd have all sorts of instances where women were getting arrested because they, you know, they get upset and they threw a hot dog at their husband, or they threw like a peanut butter jar at their husband, or they kicked him in the shin. And then the husband would, you know, call 911 stupidly, and the wife would get arrested. And this is in my own state of Virginia. This is still the case in the law, where it's mandatory arrest. If the officer has probable cause that any assault has occurred, he has to, or she has to, arrest the primary aggressor. So you have people with criminal records for throwing, you know, a hot dog in the direction of their kid. Or, you know, a father whose kid is, one case, you know, a kid was going off drunk with the car keys, not listening to his father. The father went up and grabbed him around the face and said, why are you doing this? Please. And people saw him do this. He was on a baseball field. And they called the police. The father got arrested. You mean, imagine this. So I can't think of anybody, or very few people in this country, very few reasonable people in this country, think that that father should get arrested for what he did. But we create laws that make that happen. Because we're in a state of great internal debate about how we understand violence within a family, the use of force within a family, whether it's husband towards wife or whether it's parents toward children. And I think that our, I would say almost like inability to discuss Quran 434 comes from the fact that it's so contested that to even suggest that there's some place in the world, that there's some culture in the world where there may be times when a husband is justified in striking his wife. For us to even suggest that is so horrific for many people in our country that the social cost of discussing this is just too high. People can't even discuss it. So I think that you're very right to say that this is a lot about the culture in which the discussion is taking place.
This is the last question, it's going to be a short one. We're looking to conclude the program in 4 minutes. So make the question very short, and the answer, we'll give more time for the answer.
Thank you. Do you know anything about those, some of the states are working proactively against Sharia laws, and what are the status of that? I mean, any debate? I mean, I heard about some Sharia laws are being banned in some of the states. Do you know any other details on Islamophobia and all that stuff?
I think if I'm recalling, it's like there's Tennessee, Oklahoma, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina, I believe Georgia. There's maybe 6 or 7 states that I can think of right now. There may be more where there have been either suggested, legislation, or legislation has been passed in places like Louisiana, Tennessee, Oklahoma. that prohibit Sharia, or sometimes they prohibit foreign law, because I think it was in Oklahoma that the federal district judge overturned the law as unconstitutional. I don't know what will, I'm sure, I don't think that that will be appealed because it's a ridiculous law, obviously. You know, this is a big problem. It's a stupid problem because, you know, I don't know anybody who's trying to make Sharia law take over America. I've never met any Muslim trying to do that. And it really is a problem because what happens if you're a business in Tennessee and you have a, or Oklahoma, and you have a contract with, you know, a bank in Malaysia or Abu Dhabi or Dubai that has some reference to the Sharia in the contract? What are you going to do? The judge is not allowed, technically, I guess, not allowed to hear this, the contract inadmissible before the court. Why would I do business in that state? You know, when I was doing my will, I wanted to write, you know, divide my inheritance according to Hanbali school of law. And then I thought, if I write this, maybe by that time Virginia won't have it, and it's my will will get thrown out. So I had to say, divide it up, this percentage and that percentage and things like that. It's kind of ridiculous. But what it's really saying is, you know, Muslims are not welcome here. And I wouldn't, I mean, if I lived in a state where that had that, I would seriously consider moving out personally. But I don't know. I don't want to say what I would do. Because I think that these are kind of, they're never going to affect Muslims in any meaningful way. They're just like, you know, a real slap in the face about where you're welcome. And I think maybe Muslims just need to work to make themselves more prominent, more part of those communities.
Jazakallah khair.
All right. And we also learned that you're a Hanbali based on your interest in your will as well. So we wanted to thank Dr. Jonathan Brown for coming out and spending this evening with us and sharing some of his expertise on the topic of both the Quran, approaching our sacred scripture, as well as the teachings of our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Jazakumullah khair. And I believe it's time for the adhan. So, and for those who came in late, we're looking to host a number of programs through Bayan Claremont Islamic Graduate School. Dr. Brown is one of the visiting scholars who hopefully will come back again in future years. We're looking possibly to host Professor Overmeer Enjum in February and possibly hosting him here at Institute of Knowledge as well. And we look forward to working closely with the Institute of Knowledge and Bayan Claremont in the spreading of Islamic knowledge here in Southern California. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And we have some table and brochures in the back for anyone who's interested in pursuing a master's and accredited master's degree in Islamic studies and leadership. Assalamu alaikum.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله حي على الصلاة حي على الصلاة حي على الفلاح. حي